So I'd like to, actually, in the talk tonight, I'd like to kind of follow two strands and then bring them together. And the first strand is really to ask a question. I think it's useful for us to know the answers to a few really simple questions when we do this practice. The first question is, why do we do it? And I talked a little bit about why we do it when I offered instructions for sitting this evening. Essentially, we do this practice to be free. We do it for liberation. And what does that mean? The Buddha defined liberation very simply and in a way that all of us can understand. You know, we talk, if we use the word enlightenment, we get confused. It's just too imprecise a term. But the Buddha said freedom is freedom from those qualities of consciousness which cause us great pain. It's freedom from greed, grasping greed. It's freedom from all forms of aversion like fear and hatred and anger and envy. And it's freedom from ignorance, from not understanding what is true. That's what freedom is. So, in a sense, it's about mastering our minds. It's our minds that got us into this pickle. You know, our minds have us in bondage, and it's our minds that can free us. And so what we do in this practice is that we cultivate the opposite of those qualities that keep us in bondage and suffering. Rather than greed, we practice generosity, which Valerie has just talked about. Very important in this tradition. Instead of aversion, that is fear and hatred and anger and envy and other forms of aversion, we practice loving kindness and compassion. And instead of cultivating ignorance, we find out what is true. And ultimately, it's the truth that frees us. It's the truth of coming to understand that we're not separate. It's out of our sense of being separate that all of the harm of the world happens. We come to understand that what we are all profoundly connected, and what we are is something that is whole and luminous and beautiful. That's our true being. We see that for ourselves, not just an idea, not just words, but the direct experience of that. So that's one way to put why we practice. And then another question that it's good for us to be clear about, and that is, what do we practice? And I mentioned in the instructions for the sitting is that essentially what we're practicing is both the means and the end of this beautiful path, and that is the practice of awareness, of knowing, and the practice of loving kindness. Awareness and love, those are the qualities that free us. And so we have a whole variety of ways of cultivating and deepening these qualities. It's not the love that usually this culture, the society, talks about. Actually, the concept of love mostly that we have in this society is exactly the opposite. It's about grasping greed. If love indicates you belong to me, it's actually the opposite of love. Love is seeing the beauty in beings and wishing for their happiness and their well-being. And then the third question that I think can be very useful for us to have a clear answer to, and that is the question, whom are we practicing for? It's really interesting to consider this question. Normally, people come to this liberating practice. And when I say practice, I don't mean just meditation. It's really the whole Noble Eightfold Path. It's all of the ethical aspects of the practice, as well as meditation, of really being clear about our intentions. and being really clear about our communication, of trying to communicate in ways that are helpful and not harmful, to be very clear about our actions, to try to act in ways that are helpful and not harmful, and to be very clear about our livelihood, our way of working in the world, to try to work in ways that bring happiness and don't cause suffering. So people generally come to practice with some kind of motivation for themselves. A lot of people come to practice because they've suffered a lot in their lives, may have had very painful and difficult childhoods, may have had trauma, may have had terrible losses in their lives. People may be suffering from terrible illnesses. And so people come because they want to relieve the pain. Or sometimes people come because they're just very curious. People want to know what the truth is. I've known any number of people. It's just that the movement to wanting to know the truth. In my young life, I was obsessed with only two questions, really. You know, from the time I was a pre-teenager, and those two questions are: why is there suffering, and what can I do about it? And I was probably, I don't know, maybe 22 years old before I finally found somebody with the answer. And I read and read and read and read. When other people, young people, were out playing basketball, I was reading Nietzsche. You know, just, you know, why is there suffering? And what can I do about it? And then it was just this amazing moment for me when I got an answer from the Buddha, and it was so clear. This is why they're suffering, he said. And this is what we can do about it. And suffering can be eliminated, can be uprooted. That was amazing. That was an amazing moment for me. In a sense, I've never looked back. So people, and people can come with just this idea of, you know, what's the truth? And it's, you know, it's we tend to think of the pursuit of truth as being kind of a philosophical and airy kind of mental thing. It's not. When you really seek the truth, it's actually one hell of a journey. Was it Gloria Steinem, the great feminist thinker, who said the truth will set you free, but first it will probably piss you off. And it does. It's very challenging finding out the truth. Because when we really start to uncover the truth on a deep level, it's what it does is it completely upends our reality. Is it Nisargadatta who said, the pursuit of truth is the most dangerous thing you can do because it destroys the world we know. You have to destroy the mistaken beliefs when you come to see the truth. And that's a pretty disruptive process. So people come to practice usually for very personal reasons, because they want something for themselves. Some people come with a lot of anxiety and they want tranquility and calm. And this practice brings that. Or people come with a lot of unhappiness and they want happiness and joy. Well, we do joy. And we do bliss. We can do bliss. You know, we can give you the tools. If you want bliss, I'll tell you exactly what you need to do. But then there's an interesting, and this can this kind of personal motivation of coming to practice can be reinforced in a sense by the tradition that a Western Vipassana essentially derives from the Theravada tradition from Southeast Asia, Theravada Buddhism, which is what's called the Arhant path. And the whole idea of the Arhant path is get yourself completely free and get off the wheel of suffering as soon as possible. And so it's a very personal kind of vision. But gradually what happens to people as they do this practice, and as there's a kind of purification of our consciousness, and what happens is there becomes more and more purification of our motivation. So it's inevitable, as people go deeper and deeper in this practice, that they're not practicing so much for themselves, they're practicing for all of us. You know, when you really look into the nature of suffering and its causes, the best way, the only way really to look into it is to feel it. And you come to, and you come out of denial and you start to feel your own suffering, and you know how painful that is, then it really resonates when you see someone else suffering. You know how painful it is, just as you want to be free from that, you want others to be free from that. That's compassion and empathy. Those qualities of empathy, of compassion, of loving kindness, of understanding our profound connectedness. It becomes more and more difficult to make this a personal project. Even as individualist as we Westerners are, you know, we're the most individualist civilization in the history of the world. You know, in other cultures, people would practice to liberate their family or to liberate their tribe because family and tribe are more important than individual. But here we're individualists. So out of love and compassion and this deepening sense of how connected we are, we start to really care about others. We feel their suffering. It was Philo of Alexandria, the great Jewish philosopher, who was a contemporary of Jesus, said, "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle." And we are all, you know, despite, how are you? I'm fine. How are you? You know, despite the social exterior that we put on, when we're honest about it, we're all struggling. As we come to see that, as we come to look through that facade and start to connect on a deep heart level, we know what we're doing. We know about that pain, and we care. We care about each other. And there's another way in which, through the purification that comes from this practice, it becomes more and more impossible to make it a personal project, and that is the deepening of wisdom. As wisdom deepens, you come to see that there is no separate self. That sense of separation, the me and you. You know, you're having your experience over there and it's not my experience. That sense of not me becomes more and more attenuated, more and more flimsy, and eventually disappears because we come to see that there isn't a separate self here. There are only conditions. And then practicing for self becomes a logical absurdity. I've been doing, in my daily practice, I've just been sort of playing recently. I sit, and once the mind gets a little, you know, gets calmer and more stable, then I look around and see, well, what's happening here? Well, there are just a few sensations, and there's an occasional thought, and there's an emotion, and there's awareness. There's not much at all happening here, really, when you look at it. If you're not caught up in the story and you really actually see what's happening, not much. and I sort of look and see there's not much as I'm sitting. And then there's this thought that comes, nobody's here. And nobody's here. And there's this just gleeful delight. Oh, there's nobody here. You know, it's just so freeing. It's really freeing. It's just wonderful to have nobody here. we don't disappear down some big black hole when we discover there's no self. It's just like dropping a big burden. You know, Chogyam Trungpa, the great Tibetan teacher, was asked, what is self? And he said, neurosis, you're better off without it. Or was it Nyanaponika Mahathera in Sri Lanka? He asked Jack Kornfield years and years ago, someone of those guys. He asked Jack Kornfield, you know, when Jack was a very young person, he said, well, what's the essence of the Dharma? And Jack said, there's no self. And this person was an old person at the time, a great, great practice monk, said, that's right, no self, no problem. But as we come to see that there isn't a self, and as the problem starts more and more to fall away, then then clearly we're practicing for all of us. And then there's also the concept from the Mahayana tradition, a different strain of Buddhism, the concept of the Bodhisattva. So instead of getting free and getting off that wheel of suffering as fast as you can, the path of the Arhant, which is an absolutely valid path, but the Mahayana vision is a larger one. It's basically saying, why would you want to get off the wheel of suffering if others are suffering? And so people make a commitment to be here until every being is free. And I took that vow 10 years ago, even though Mahayana is not my tradition. I thought actually something happened that made it impossible not to take the Bodhisattva vow. And so when I sit, you know, one of my reflections when I sit is I commit my life and all future lives to the liberation of beings from their suffering. May all my thoughts, all my words, and all my actions contribute to this purpose. It's like, there is a very clear purpose for this life. And then I've mentioned many times that I try to make the last thought before I go to sleep at night and the first thought when I wake up in the morning, for as long as space and time endure, I will abide to relieve the suffering of living beings. It's a really wonderful kind of intention to have. So we ultimately, even if we think that we're practicing for ourselves, when you liberate one mind, you're liberating on some level, you're liberating all minds. Your practice touches the experience on some subtle level of every living being in the universe. We are all that profoundly interconnected. So we practice for each other. When we take refuge in the three jewels, you know, the third of those jewels, the three precious things, we take refuge in Sangha. And when we take refuge in Sangha, we're basically receiving the support of the community of practitioners, of people who aspire to freedom. But we're also giving that support. I don't see how you can really take refuge in Sangha and not be practicing for other beings. It doesn't make sense to me. So that's one strand of this talk. And the other strand I'd like to develop and just step back and look historically for a moment. The Buddha said, someday these liberating teachings will disappear from the world and they will no longer be available. And when these teachings disappear from the world, then people will not be able to free themselves. They won't have the information. And that hasn't happened yet. You know, we're all sitting in this room, you know, in late October of the year 2009 as an immediate result of what happened to that person under a tree over 2,500 years ago. What, around 529 BCE or something like that. It's a direct result of his awakening that we're here tonight in this gathering. I think that's amazing. There's this causal chain. So the teachings haven't yet disappeared from the world, and to me that's a miracle. And what that required was actually, there have been over 100 generations since the Buddha. And what that required is for every generation to take these practices seriously enough, to go deep with these practices, and then to pass it to the next generation. And actually, these practices can't be learned from a book. You know, you can learn the concepts of the Dharma from a book, but actually freedom is passed person to person. It's a direct transmission. You know, from a mind that has experienced some freedom, helping others to experience freedom. It has to happen person to person. And so there's been, I just feel such amazing gratitude that there's been this unbroken chain. of generation after generation after generation who have valued these teachings enough to actually practice and have taken the practice deep enough to experience some liberation and pass it on to the next generation. And so that made it possible for me at the age of 21 in, you know, as a sophomore or junior in college to read the Buddha's teachings in an Asian history class and to connect. Oh, somebody knows why they're suffering and what I can do about it. Such gratitude. And I can just say for myself, I would not be alive if it weren't for this practice. I would have died a long time ago. So, and I owe my life to this practice in a very, very concrete way. So, enormous gratitude. What has happened in the last, say, mostly 60 years since, or 60 plus years, 64, 65 years since the end of the Second World War? What has happened in Asia is that actually the Buddhist traditions are losing energy. There have been any number of assaults on the Dharma in these last six decades, or thereabouts, six and a half, seven decades. There have been any number of communist regimes, for example, which have either really suppressed or even tried to uproot Buddhism from their native cultures. So, for example, in China, in communist China, in Tibet, in Mongolia, in Laos, in Vietnam, and especially in Cambodia, where that terrible genocide happened in the 70s, is where the effort was made to simply to destroy Buddhism under the Pol Pot regime. And then there have been countries where the Dharma has been weakened by horrible dictatorships and oppression. So in Burma, where there's been a military junta has run Burma since 1962, it has been extraordinarily brutal. And the Dharma survives in Burma. Actually, my own lineage of the Dharma comes from Burma. So I feel such a deep connection there. But, you know, that regime was machine gunning, as you know, monks down in the streets 2 and 3 years ago. And in Sri Lanka, you know, where there has been this brutal civil war going on for decades, and the Buddhist culture has been weakened by it, because our culture is all about loving kindness, not about killing, even if it's done in the name of Buddhism, as it has been in Sri Lanka. The Tamils have been Muslim. The main culture has been Buddhist, and the main culture has been horrifically oppressive. And then also, the Dharma has been under assault from materialism, by capitalism and materialism in places like Japan and Thailand. So Ajahn Chah, the great Thai teacher, said when he came to the West, somebody asked him, what's the difference between teaching Asians and Westerners, and he said, well, it feels to me that when I'm teaching in Asia, it's like watering an old and dying tree. And he said, when I'm here in the West, it feels like I'm watering some new young shoot. And so I think, I can't say for sure, but the trend seems to be that it might be up to us here in the West to keep these teachings going. You know, just looking back at the whole historic picture, it may be up to us, because there's so much enthusiasm. This is all so new to us. It's only been a generation or two that we've had really had the Dharma in this culture. And, you know, we have that new launching kind of energy for the Dharma here in the West. So it may be up to us to be the link in that chain that goes back over 100 generations of experiencing the Dharma deeply, experiencing freedom, and passing it on to the next generation. So I think that there's one danger, actually, seems to me. There's one danger in this. If that really is our responsibility to kind of keep it going, and I think it is, what I've seen, when I began serious Dharma practice serious spiritual practice in the mid-1970s, we were mostly in our 20s. There were some people in their 30s. I was in my 20s. And I would go to retreats, and we were mostly young people there. It's wonderful to have young folks here tonight, but what would you say the average age is of the people who come here on Thursday evenings? Anyone want to give a guess?
50.
Yeah, so those of us, you know, the boomers, we boomer people, you know, in our 20s, and now it's kind of people in their 50s and 60s and 70s. Do you have some sense about what the problem is? In 20 years, I would be approaching 85. And my family doesn't live that long. So even if I were alive at 85, even if this body were still functioning enough to come here and give a talk to you, there's no guarantee that the brain is going to be functioning enough. You know, there's a bunch of cognitive function that's just kind of disappearing down the memory hole or something. This brain's not working as well as it did 20 years ago. What's it going to be working like in 20 more years? So I'd like to ask you, how old will you be in 20 years? Each one of you. So some of you will be just right in the flower of adulthood. I can see some young faces here. But how old will you be in 20 years?
Too old.
Yeah, most of us are going to be dead in 20 years.
Yeah.
And so what happens? What will happen? You know, when I first became the resident teacher of this community, the Albuquerque Vipassana Sangha, I remember saying to this community, I look forward to this community helping people to liberate themselves 500 years from now, at least 500. And that's the time frame that I'm thinking in. You know, I'm here for all of time and space, so hey, you know. It may be up to us to kind of give the Buddha's dispensation of keeping these liberating teachings alive. It may be up to us to give it another 2,500 years. But what's likely to happen to this Sangha in 20 years? Is it even going to be here if it continues to be an aging group? So if we are not practicing for ourselves, and if we're practicing for others, and if we really want people to be free, wouldn't it be useful for us to be concerned about the liberation of young people? I'm not talking about going out and recruiting. We don't do that. You know, we don't recruit. We don't proselytize in this tradition. People come. So it's not about recruiting people to the Dharma. It's about really caring about their freedom. And I would like to really encourage, are there any board members here this evening? I'd really like to encourage the board to talk about this issue. You know, if we're just practicing for ourselves, yeah, we can go further into geezerhood and die. It's okay. But we're not just practicing for ourselves. You know, just as we all know, you know, just taking an analogy here. So when we get out of school, we don't refuse to pay taxes to keep schools going because we know the value we know the value of education. Without education, we're really in trouble. And after our children are grown, we still are willing to pay taxes. You know, and even after our grandchildren are grown, we're still willing to pay taxes for school because we see the value of that. If normal kind of schooling is something we're willing to support, wouldn't we be willing to give this amazing liberating tools to younger people? And I just want to share with you a hope. So I'm just a little bit older than the boomer generation, but I kind of grew up with them. And I can remember a time when we really cared about justice and we cared about equality and we cared about peace and we were passionate about it. We didn't buy basically the message from the society that if you become rich and famous, you're going to be perfectly happy. You know, Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley and Kurt Cobain, and they were rich and famous, and they were miserable and died young. And I have to say, I've been waiting for another generation that had those values, and I'm seeing it actually. It's called the millennial generation, the people who are coming of age now. Is what I'm seeing, and what I'm hearing from the demographers is that there's a generation coming along now that is clearly expressing an interest in justice and equality, who really care about the environment, who are really networked, who don't buy the whole bit about materialism and consumption and greed that has run the society, essentially. There is a generation coming along with these very good values, and because of those values, they are ripe for interest in spiritual practice. And, you know, you got to sort of get the sex, drugs, and rock and roll out of your system before you kind of really turn toward spiritual practice. Not everybody, but I did. But they're ripe for it. And I could just hope that we can keep the Dharma going long enough for this generation really to connect. To spiritual practice. And we can make that transmission. We can pass the torch before we die to another generation who might pass the torch to another generation. And let's hope for another 2,500 years for these teachings and practice. So I've been having an email correspondence with a teacher named Temple Smith, who has been teaching for years. He's also now formally in teacher training with Jack Kornfield to be a Vipassana teacher. And Temple's work has been specifically and especially with youth. And Temple is interested in actually coming and doing offering a Vipassana retreat specifically for youth here in New Mexico. And I've been encouraging him. And he asked me for contacts. You know, I serve several sanghas here in the Southwest, and he asked me for contacts, and I've provided contacts. I don't know if he's contacted this community yet. But I'd like to encourage you to really support Temple and to see what other way it might be possible really to connect to young people. I know that the Durango Sangha for many years now, there's a younger person who went through the community Dharma Leader program, who has been teaching a meditation class at a college in Durango for years, and there's been an interest in the Dharma through her work, and young people have been coming to the Durango Sangha, and the young people come to the retreats. You know, there's a doorway there. And so it might be possible for this community also to have such a doorway for young people. It's just, you know, we've just changed the format of my coming here after many years of my coming every month and giving a talk once a month. We've just changed that. So next year, in 2010, I won't be coming every month. I'll be coming to give 2 4-week series. So in March and then in November next year, I'll come 4 weeks in a row, 4 Thursdays in a row, and we'll offer those 4 weeks on a single topic, and we can go deeper. I did that with the Santa Fe Sangha in August, and it was really wonderful. We had a great time. But that means that, you know, I've had this wonderful privilege of just coming and riffing on whatever subject interests me, you know, without even announcing it ahead of time. I just, you know, whatever is really I really connect to, I come and I talk to you about. And it's been this and that. And the reason I'm giving this talk this evening is this. There are only 2 more times when I can sort of come and talk about a subject of my own choice, because I'm going to be constrained by those 2 subjects next year. And so that's why I wanted to bring up the subject of, you know, really to ask, whom do we practice for? And if it's clear that we're not just practicing for ourselves, and if we really value these teachings and have some sense about what a precious gift we've been given by 100 generations, is to see if it's possible to care about the young and to make these tools available to the young. So thank you for hearing this out. Any comments or questions, please?
I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this very clearly. The elimination of suffering. Okay. And by the way, for the last 10 years, I come out of the Mahayana tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is still the same, no matter
yeah.
which tradition. I can wrap my head around a personal suffering and liberation from personal suffering and the practice. This I can deal with that. What I don't know how to hold is the unspeakable suffering that has been caused in the last 100 years. I mean, the unspeakable suffering as a result of war, what's going on in
right.
yeah. Palestine, I mean, Africa,
right.
colonialism, slavery.
Yes.
That is unspeakable,
yes.
continuous suffering. I don't know how to hold it.
It's hard to hold, but let me, if I may, just give you my take on this. The Buddha said that the source of all suffering are these qualities, what he called the root tormentors of our minds and hearts, of greed, aversion, and ignorance. And we can look in our own hearts and minds, and we can see, if we're honest, and we really look in an honest way, we can see the way greed, aversion, and ignorance generated out of these minds and hearts causes suffering. Institutions.
Yeah.
Institutions are essentially our projected mind states. We collectively project these mind states, and then they congeal into institutions. And so we can have institutions that are founded on generosity, love, compassion, and wisdom. Or we can have institutions that are founded on greed, hatred, and delusion. And so the Pentagon.
Okay.
You know, there's an institution, the institution of war, as you were saying, colonialism. You know, if you really want to unpack it, you can see there the workings of greed, aversion, and delusion. And so our task, you know, I have an absolute feeling about this. Our task is free this heart from greed, aversion, delusion. Free that heart and that one and that one. And eventually what we do is we project different qualities of consciousness. I believe that we can have enlightened presidents and enlightened senators and enlightened cabinet members and enlightened governors and enlightened mayors. And if we have a population of a people who have freed themselves enough, and this practice works, it does work. If there is this purification that happens, if there are enough people who have freed themselves, those institutions will melt away by themselves. They will. You know, they just won't. We won't have any use for them. We can turn. I think we should turn the Pentagon either into a giant skating rink or into low-income housing. You know? Yeah, yeah. So that's it, and the reason I really appreciate this question is like they've been asking me in New Zealand. They've been asking me to come for 10 years to teach in New Zealand. I keep saying yeah, later, and finally some guy came over here, you know, and sat with me. He said, I've been saving for 4 years to come and sit with you, and I said, really? And he said, do you know the teachers in New Zealand are all ex-monastics and they do not believe in socially engaged spirituality? And I said, really? And that convinced me. I said, okay, I'm coming. And I want to give a retreat on socially engaged spirituality. You know, it's like Gandhi, right? You know, I've been thinking a whole lot about it because I'm getting ready to go. And I'm reading about, you know, their treatment of the Maori. It was very similar to our treatment of our indigenous people. You know, there's plenty work to do in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So yes. Okay. So we free our hearts and then we free the institutions. And we do it at the same time. You know, so I really support you to do that. And don't feel despair. It's only the mind.
Yeah, okay.
The mind got us into this problem, and the mind can get us out of this problem. And if we have enough free minds, we will free up our society.
Wow.
This is only, you know, I've been reading a lot about Lincoln recently, and I think we actually had a bodhisattva president. I think we had a truly transformational leader who was incredibly empathic, incredibly compassionate, amazingly skilled in the most critical crisis this country has ever had. And this is only a personal opinion. I think we have a transformational leader now. And I think we ought to be really behind that. Whatever criticism we can make of him being too centrist or whatever, there is a very developed mind there. And that's a damn good thing. You know, to have that at the top of the power structure, and I think we should be supporting that as much as we can. I don't mean to be partisan in my politics; it's just my own opinion. So, thank you for that question. Yeah.
When you're talking about the next generation of practitioners, you got interested in your 20s. Don't you think that a lot of the young people today, as they get a little older and start experiencing some more of the suffering, that they're going to start finding us?
Well, where are the people in their 30s and 40s that, you know, did we lose two generations?
Yeah.
I mean, there's somehow or other, the generations between my generation and this generation sitting here got a little bit lost to spiritual practice. I mean, some of them are involved, but generally speaking, they were into the greed that was so prevalent in the 1980s, let's put it that way. I'm not going to use a name. Mm-hmm. So
haven't they sort of been referred to as the me generation?
Yeah, exactly. So, but
I think
take a look at these millennials. There's real hope there. So just, yes.
Are you going to practice on us with this socially engaged retreat or come back and do it for us?
I'd be happy to do that.
I would love to be a part of it.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to do that. I'm really doing a lot of research, you know, before I go to New Zealand, so I'll be prepped. So it's March.
Either as practice or after you've done it, come back.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Well, it'll be March and April 2011, and so I'll, you know, after I come back, I'd be happy to do something.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it'd be nice to get that jazzed up here.
I'm going just immediately.
No. It's a lot of preparation.
I'd like to recommend a fall retreat.
Final question.
I have a question. I was thinking about the bodhisattva.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if the bodhisattva carries the dharma, then how does the sasana become completely extinguished so that the teachings are lost?
That's a very good question. Maybe the bodhisattva.
Can you say the question again, please?
Yeah, it's essentially her question was, if the bodhisattva is here for all of time and space, you know, it's like the vow of the bodhisattva is, I will be here until, and to help beings with their suffering until every single person is free, and then I'm going to be the last to go out the door and, you know, close the door behind. If that's true, then how can the Buddha's teachings get lost? I think that's a beautiful question, and I don't know the answer to it. I'll tell you what, I'll get back to you in 5 lifetimes, and I'll bet I'll have an answer by then. Thank you. That's a fantastic question. If you have an answer, let me know. Okay, friends, thank you so much.